Welcome to the Legacy Podcast. This podcast is a series of conversations centered around understanding the values, beliefs, and intentions behind leaving a legacy. You will hear from successful business owners just like yourself who want to leave an impact for generations to come. Let's get started.
Welcome to the Business Legacy Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host today. So join us on a journey when we walk through with business owners like yourself, their successes, failures, and legacy that they want to leave behind. Whether you're a present business owner, recently retired owner, or looking to build your legacy, we really tear down the walls of cultural sensitivity to help you explore your own legacy. What do you want your legacy to look like? So this week, we have Thomas Davenport. How are you doing today, Thomas?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. Well, we brought Thomas on because, you know, we spend a lot of time here talking with business owners about their legacy, and Thomas focuses more on the exit part of the strategy that businesses have when they're looking to move on to greener pastures. Thomas, tell us a little about your background.
Sure. So I grew up in and around financial services. My mom's a financial advisor. Out of undergrad, I worked on the financial advisory side and then transitioned into investment banking and had a kind of traditional Wall Street career. Worked at Citigroup, worked at some leading middle market investment banks, and now I run my own independent firm called Davenport Capital Management. And we focus on helping owner entrepreneurs preserve their legacy through succession planning and ultimately helping them exit their business, recapitalize it, or find other financial partners to help bring that business to the next level.
Why did you decide to get into this part of the business? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you have a well-rounded perspective on the financial services industry, but why becoming an M&A advisor? What kind of drew you to that profession?
For me, the attraction was it was kind of a good blend of what I call right brain and left brain activity. It's very relational. You've got to understand folks' stories, their backgrounds, their motivations, but then you've also got to have a good handle on the numbers to make the business case work. And then there's a lot of negotiation. The ability to leverage multiple disciplines to drive outcomes for business owners, I just found that attractive.
What are some of the biggest challenges you come up against, you know, when working with business owners?
I think the biggest challenge we see now is really timing and expectations with regards to proceeds and their needs. And then one piece that's non-financial, that's a very big piece of the equation, is their legacy. How do they want the company to be remembered? Whose hands do they want to place it in to take it to the next level? And we give a lot of time and consideration around what does this company look like when that owner entrepreneur, maybe second or third generation ownership group, leaves the business into someone else's hands? And so that's a big part of what we think about, and it becomes a large part of our considerations when we're running a process.
Yeah, and we talk a lot about this in the show, but let's kind of dive into that a little bit. Like, what should people be expecting, right? Because you've got a business owner and they come to you and say, hey, I'm looking to exit, right? This last year with COVID just really wore me down. How should they be thinking about it? What should they be looking at when they're looking to make that move?
I think the first piece is, in an ideal world, I would meet with a client, you know, a year and a half to 2 years out from ultimately them exiting the business. That would give us time to kind of catalog strengths and weaknesses, kind of do an internal SWOT analysis, think about succession planning, help them with any internal financial adjustments. There are things that they may run through the business that a private equity buyer or future family buyer may not have those same expenses and cost structure. And so really right-sizing that and having 12 months of financial presentation that's very clean, that a buyer can understand, that showcases the business as well as we can showcase it.
It's good to know. I mean, you know, 1.5, 2 years out, that's good. That's definitely some planning that people would have to do. But you kind of mentioned some other things. So what other things kind of come to mind? So somebody's selling their business, like what are some of the psychological challenges that people are going to kind of face?
I think one big piece is preparing. What are you going to do afterwards? Do you want to remain with the business? Do you want to be chairman of the board? Do you want to continue to have a sales role in the business? What have you, and it's also what have you made peace with? What are you comfortable with? Some sellers have been in the business long enough and made peace early in the process, and they're ready to move on as soon as the ink is dry on the purchase agreement. For other sellers, they may want to roll some equity, and they think, you know, participating with someone else's capital on the growth of the business, and they see more growth avenues. And so they kind of want what we call a second bite of the apple and everything in between: consulting agreements, continued participation, roles for children that may be in the business that may not be have the financial wherewithal to buy the business, but want to continue to leave their legacy by growing their career through the business. I mean, there's a lot of considerations that we put together as we're thinking about an exit, and having the time, and I always say to make peace with it, to understand this is what we're willing to do, this is what we like, and then also have an advisor that's willing to fight for those avenues of growth or those mechanisms in the deal post-close to ensure that you get what you want out of the transaction, not just the monetary proceeds.
Yeah, I would imagine that working with the inheritance of the business, if you will, or next generation, you know, of kids, I imagine that's got to be a difficult transition process for a lot of parents. When you've kind of worked with people with that, like, what have you seen that people should really be thinking about when they're talking to their children about it?
I think there's a few things. One, I think there's the grooming of the successor and making sure that the child is prepared from a management perspective. And if you really want them to inherit the business versus transitioning to third-party ownership, just make sure you put them in a place where if they're not ready, you've put enough human resources and capital around them to get them ready and have some type of kind of promotional plan in place or a skill set development plan. What I've seen is a lot of family owners will send their children to work outside the business and then come back with new ideas. And in an ideal world, if the parent's ready to retire, when that child is ready to take on the responsibility, that's great. And if it's not, if there's some hiccup in that, then just making sure that you shore up the business to ensure that the child has all the support around them that they need to eventually, you know, become the leadership of the business.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great advice. So what are some, I mean, let's talk a little bit about some ways that people can exit, because there's a few different ways people can exit the business, but maybe you can kind of talk about some of those so people kind of understand what some of the possibilities are, you know, when they're going through this process.
Sure. So there's kind of what we call a traditional buyout, where you sell to a third party, whether that be a strategic buyer, so another buyer that's participating in your industry. In theory, in corporate finance theory 101, strategic buyers pay the highest multiples. That's not necessarily been the case in recent years, but there should be some synergy around selling to someone that's already participating in your space, has a sales force, has an internal cost structure that they can leverage your resources and cut cost post-close. Then you could also sell into private equity. And private equity comes in a number of different flavors. There's kind of your traditional buyout funds. There's minority equity participants, so folks that want to buy a non-control interest in a business to help bridge to an exit. So you might say there's a lot of opportunity in, say, you're a plastics injection molder. There's a lot of opportunity in the space to roll up other injection molders, and you've got people from your trade organization that you know they're ready to sell. You're not quite ready to sell, and you think putting those companies together would allow for a better exit multiple. Then you could bring on a minority capital partner who's got M&A expertise, because a lot of middle market firms don't have M&A expertise in-house, and then allow them to help, one, shore up the balance sheet and provide the dry powder to go do those acquisitions, but also support you through integration, support you through professionalizing the organization, maybe formalizing a true board. And so there's ways to kind of, again, do a two-step process where you sell a piece of the company today for an ultimate exit later on, and ideally by selling, you know, taking in the capital early, you're going to execute on a growth plan that's going to benefit your exit tremendously on the back. And then there's ESOPs. There are employee stock ownership programs. You can sell the business effectively to the employees, and there's some tax advantages associated with that. I do not personally spend a lot of time with ESOPs, but there are ESOP specialists that can kind of tout the merits of those transactions. I think the challenge there is that in today's environment, usually an ESOP is not going to be your highest and best offer from a proceeds standpoint. So a lot of buyers, most buyers, opt for a traditional sale process to private equity or to a strategic buyer.
Yeah, I've noticed that private equity is paying up quite handedly right now in this environment.
They are.
Are there certain industries that tend to have higher multiples than others, or how is this? I mean, I kind of feel. I mean, you do this every day. You tell me, but it kind of feels like right now multiples are a lot higher than normal, and there's a lot of money chasing these kind of deals. Is this kind of a normal environment, or is this kind of like a special environment that people should be really aware of?
This is a high watermark environment in terms of activity, in terms of cheap capital, and in terms of multiples and aggressiveness from private equity buyers. Multiples are up dramatically. M&A activity is up dramatically since the slump that occurred right when COVID hit. The M&A market has come roaring back. And so it's a great time to be a seller, but from a private equity perspective, it's very competitive for good businesses. To your point about, valuations, what private equity firms that are paying these record multiples are looking for is growth. So any industry that's got significant projected growth to get a platform company that they can work with and execute on a growth value creation plan that's going to be highly growth oriented, those command the best multiples. So that tends to be things in technology, tech-enabled services, healthcare are big industries where there's a lot of projected growth, things that are not as people intensive or fixed asset intensive and have a higher margin profile tend to command better multiples.
So that was going to be one of the questions I was going to ask is what are really the buyers looking for right now? Like, are there certain metrics or certain characteristics of the business, or what typically are people looking for?
Everything is industry relative, I would say. Your margin and your growth profile relative to your peer set determines whether you get a premium multiple in your sector or not so premium multiple. Scale matters as well. I mean, there's scale inflection points in businesses where if you're over $100 million in sales, that tends to get an incremental bump. There's EBITDA. Yeah, so it's really margin and growth, making sure that from a basic perspective that you have to have a saleable business, you've got to have an independent management team where you are not a critical piece. You as the owner are not a critical piece of the business. You may provide strategic oversight. You may write and sign all the checks. But ultimately, once that owner transitions away from the business, that business can continue to operate, or you can hire a professional manager to replace the business owner's functions, which means that sales and marketing relationships tend to reside in the firm and not in the ownership group. So that's kind of the first litmus test, if you will, when we're talking to prospects around selling their business. Do you have a saleable asset? Can this asset truly be independent of your presence and your leadership?
Yeah, that's a big one. I think people underestimate the power of the owner in terms of what they bring to the business. I know some businesses are generally well run and they're independent of the owner, meaning the owner set them up to be independent of them so they can just decide not to come in one day and the business isn't going to change. But then there's others that are heavily reliant upon the owner. So how do you advise somebody who has a business who's heavily reliant on the owner and they want to exit? Like, how do you advise them or what changes should you advise them to make so they can, the business can be a little more independent of the owner?
So that's why kind of the lead time that I mentioned earlier in the interview, that's where that comes into play. If you give us a year or two, we can kind of do an assessment and an analysis and have candid conversations and even talk to maybe some customers around just the business relationship. Obviously, not under the guise if we're going to sell the business because that could impact your relationships, but just to understand the nature of those customer relationships and who they view themselves doing business with. Kirk, as you can appreciate, in our business, a lot of times these things are very much relationship driven on the wealth management side, as well as the investment banking side. Whereas in a manufacturing business, hopefully you've got a series of contacts and connection points for a client, even if from the initial sale you bring them in, that they are serviced by the broader business. And just having a good understanding of that. And if they are the business, and there are cases where the ownership group, they are the business, or you see this a lot in sibling owned businesses where you've got 3 to 5 siblings in the business and they're all doing the senior leadership functions. That family is the business. And being thoughtful about how you plan your succession and, start to carve some of those siblings out of the business or some of the family out of the business and replace them with, professional roles just makes for a lot easier sale process on the back end, because private equity buyers are very concerned about that because they're looking to buy a company that's got, a complete or nearly complete management team. And then some strategic buyers are sensitive to it as well, depending on what critical functions those family members are serving. So if you find yourself either having significant relationships where you're driving all the business into the firm, thinking about bifurcating those duties or doing some succession planning around roles and responsibilities under your oversight so you don't have any slippage, you can always be a backstop, but try to make those sales and client relationships obviously firm related versus being owner operator related.
What about employees? Because I imagine this is probably a big problem when the business owner is looking to sell and the employees, well, I guess there's multiple layers to this, but the employees may get a little antsy about that. So what do you advise people to think about from an employee perspective on how to handle that transition?
What we typically encourage is that employees that you feel like are key to the operations, that you bring them under the tent when appropriate. You don't want to bring them in too early as part of the ideation process. It likely will cloud their daily responsibilities. But to the extent that you can bring them in once you've decided to go, bring them under the tent, make them maybe give them some type of sale bonus or incentive structure around the sale process. That way they're not shy about fielding diligence questions and their interests are aligned with yours. And then I think to the extent that a buyer is looking at the business or, you want the buyer to recognize this as a key employee, you have them participate in the management presentations. You have them get to know the seller as a part of the process. And a lot of times if you've got a chief salesperson or a chief operating officer who's going to stay with the business, we may have them present the business overview, where they become the business face to that buyer and the owner operator takes a step back and provides maybe supplemental commentary, supplemental information, but you allow the business and the current management team to shine for the new prospective owner.
Okay, great. I love that. So, I don't know, maybe you can give me an example of a company that you worked with that maybe there was a mistake that happened, or some example that I think people can kind of pull some wisdom from, if you're so inclined to share without sharing the name.
Sure. I had a client once that we were in the middle of a sale process. I think he had decided early on who he wanted to sell to. And instead of running the business in ordinary course, he started steering contracts to that prospective buyer. Ultimately, that buyer got bought out by a private equity firm, and the new firm didn't want to do the deal. They didn't want to buy my client. And so he effectively kind of out of the ordinary course of business steered business to what he thought eventually was going to be like a synergistic combination ultimately just ended up being just another competitor in the market that he was steering business to. And then he had to kind of recover and find a new buyer. And we did find him a new buyer home, but the deal, because of some of the wrinkles and some of the customer concentration and things that he had going on, the deal was not as lucrative as the initial deal with that other prospective seller that he was filtering business to. And so that was just kind of a judgment thing where we always encourage sellers to operate the business as if they're not going to sell. So whatever decision you think is rational and prudent in ordinary course, stay that course, because things happen in transactions. There are hiccups. Buyers go away. They can be very, very hot and heavy, and then they disappear for a while. These things do happen, especially in kind of smaller transactions. So that was kind of a strategic mistake that happened. I'll give you another example. I was working on behalf of a buyer who was buying a company from a seller, and the seller had significant customer concentration with a manufacturer. That manufacturer mothballed a facility and so stopped production, and the earnings were cut in half. And this all happened in the middle of the process, and neither the banker nor the seller were fully upfront about that hiccup. And it caused a lot of mistrust in the process. Ultimately, the deal fell apart. And I believe that seller had to go back to market and sell at a lower valuation, even though the business had recovered, just because once you mess up the momentum of a process, other buyers know these things and won't pay you full and fair value because they're expecting that there's going to be other shoes that drop. So the other piece on top of running an ordinary course, I always tell folks, you know, anything that's ugly or uncomfortable or doesn't make the business look good, let's get it out in front of buyers early. That way we know as we're getting close to the end and everybody spent a lot of money on attorneys and accountants, that you got a deal, that you got something that you're going to get done. You can't hide the ball and expect to slide the purchase agreement under the wall like Indiana Jones and think there's going to be no repercussions.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because I think, you know, when I think about your role and your profession, you know, investment banking, I can, you know, the way I see it is a bunch of people sitting in a room, you know, they're playing poker with each other, kind of, you know, just who's going to blink first and trying to wrap up a deal. But it sounds to me like when you're dealing with business owners, it's really not that way, right? As you say, you're kind of sharing. I guess the trust is a big factor here. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that plays in and how people should be thinking about it?
Sure. So trust is huge. You've got to have one thing we're always looking for if you're looking to advise a buyer is make sure you have a willing seller. And again, has that seller made peace with parting with this asset? Do they know what they want? Can they make decisions around that? Are they shepherding the business like they should to deliver you an asset that is as unblemished as a middle market company can be? And so there is very much a delicate dance of getting to know a seller from a buyer perspective or getting to know a buyer from a seller perspective, really making sure that both parties are comfortable. It's almost like a job interview. You know, is this buyer going to be a good cultural fit for my management team? Particularly if you're, like I said, a second or third generation business owner, a lot of your management team is like family. And so who are you going to entrust your family with once you depart from the business? There's very much a relationship and trust building exercise that has to take place. And we do that over a series of calls. Usually as folks show value for a business, we'll do dinner with the management teams so that people can see each other outside of the corporate setting and get a comfort level on who ultimately they're going to be working with. Because a lot of these private equity firms are looking at a 3 to 7 year horizon, sometimes as much as 10, to work with this company. And their management team. And for key managers, you know, a lot of those folks stay along for the entire holding period. So it is definitely a two-way vetting process where folks got to understand and trust each other at enough level to, you know, make a multi-million dollar decision around buying or selling.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's helpful. I think it's always important for people to understand the mindset around how people should be thinking about different parts in this process. You know, especially a business owner that's looking to sell, is that, you know, you should be looking at the buyer as you know, as kind of a collaborative process as opposed to an adversarial one. But,
correct.
But that kind of brings into this thing. So what if it's a strategic buyer, right? So you got a competitor. Let's say you're looking to sell the business and you have your competitor and they're the best option. You know, I think there's something that comes into play here, which is, yeah, it'd be a great fit for them. They would love to do it. However, what if you don't fully trust them and you're afraid that they're going to, you know, bail out of the deal? They're going to come get your information and they're just going to bail out. So how do you address that from both the buyer and the seller standpoint?
Sure. So if in a situation like that, where we've got a highly competitive strategic who could be predatory, but we're also thinking they may pay the best price, we'll stage the transaction. So we'll do a lot of the corporate matchmaking, or I call corporate dating process, with other buyers. And then we'll bring in the strategic on the back end of the process and put them on a very tight timeline. You may even give them their own data room that's limited in nature so that you're not giving out competitive secret sauce, and put pressure on them to, just because they don't need as much information as a private equity buyer that's stepping into this business cold, or this industry potentially cold. You can give them enough high level information, and much of it they may already have an idea of or know just from their own in-house competitive landscape cataloging, but you effectively, you're confirming kind of, this is the size of the business. These are the key personnel. This is, you know, this is what financial performance looks like, and this is what we expect, and have them put out a bid and see if they can be competitive. And a lot of times we'll lay out for them what we think are the synergies for them buying the business as well. And so, you know, to the extent that a seller is very skittish about a buyer, we tend to massage the process a little bit for that buyer, and also kind of just keep them on a tighter timeline so that you don't, they're not exposed to your data too long, or not as long as other buyers might be in the process that are getting up to speed on the business.
Yeah, no, that's good. No, I appreciate that. So as we kind of get close to wrapping it up here, I'm going to ask you final question. We asked many of the guests, which is, you know, how do you want to be remembered? I mean, this podcast is about legacy. And so let's say you're sitting down, you're writing your own obituary, and, you know, how does it portray you? How do you want to be remembered?
I think two things. I'm still evaluating, I guess, the existential calling aspect, but I enjoy advising leaders and helping them make strategic decisions. And so what I enjoy about my business is helping middle market families and owner entrepreneurs exit their businesses in a thoughtful and methodical manner. And to the extent that I'm able to create value for them and their families and be remembered by my clients as someone who fought hard for them and helped them ultimately exit and create generational wealth, I think that's a big piece. And then I think for the folks that work for my firm or collaborate with my firm, it's really about mentorship. And if I can train someone else up to be successful in this business so that they can do a lot of the things and continue the mission of creating value and creating generational wealth for owner entrepreneurs, I think I've done a lot of my part, at least on the business front.
Great. Well, Thomas, I really appreciate you coming to the show here and sharing your wisdom with us. Where can people find more about you?
So you can find out more about me. LinkedIn's probably the best way to connect with me. So it's Thomas Davenport. I'm managing partner at Davenport Capital Management. And that's probably LinkedIn's probably the best method to reach out to me. And I'm fairly responsive on LinkedIn.
Okay, awesome. Well, I will put that link in the show notes, and certainly link to your website as well, so people can find more about you. But Thomas, I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your wisdom with us. I think it's going to be helpful for a lot of business owners who are looking at their legacy for themselves. So thanks again for joining us.
Sure. Thanks, Kurt. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Legacy Podcast. Now, if you can do us a favor and leave a review, any type of stars on any platform that you use, it would be greatly appreciated. For more information about us, the other co-hosts, and the Legacy Podcast, go to businesslegacypodcast.com. That's businesslegacypodcast.com. Have a great day.